Morning, counsel.
Morning. May it please the court. At stake in this case are veterans' employment rights. The Air Force may not waive those rights through a process of collective bargaining. Yet the union's proposals here, the two proposals, demand just that. Proposal one would end the jobs of VRA participants, veterans' recruitment appointments. Proposal two would halt the hiring, making new VRA hires. That impairment of veterans' rights is the extraordinary circumstance that establishes the court's jurisdiction and permits the court to vindicate the rights for veterans who are not in this courtroom today.
The difficulty I have with that approach, and it's consistent with what opposing counsel argues in the brief, it's rather circular. You're saying the court should, the relief you're wanting is the court should reverse on the basis of this error. And then the counter argument is, well, you didn't argue that error below. Your counter to that argument is, well, the court ought to take it up anyway because it's so erroneous. Well, it would seem to me that we don't get to the question of whether it's erroneous unless there is a special factor that makes it capable of being raised on appeal, and the factor that you offer as a special factor seems to be, well, it's erroneous.
Your Honor,
you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Conceitedly, there is an overlap, and it reminds me of a similar overlap, and there's certainly a distinction here, but a similar overlap in a case this court decided last spring in Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. There, it was a constitutional issue that was involved, and there was a waiver question there. And the court said, you know, there's an overlap between the merits of the constitutional issue and the question of whether we can entertain it. And certainly there is an overlap here, and we're not comparing this to a constitutional issue.
Haven't you just identified the problem with relying on that case? There are no constitutional issues here, right?
There's correct, and we're not relying on that in that sense. I was merely suggesting that.
But I'm relying on that for my point. That highlights the challenge that you face. We have construed extraordinary circumstances very narrowly, because the plain language of the statute, there's an argument the plain language of the statute might not even justify the construction we've given to it, but be that as it may, we construe it very narrowly, and as far as I can tell, the only time that we've found these extraordinary circumstances have been when there's a constitutional issue involved, and you don't have that here.
No, we don't, Your Honor.
So you're arguing for something that we've never done before.
That's correct, Your Honor, and there's a reason for that. And I, as I said in my introduction, it's a situation where, you know, nominally it's the Air Force, but what we're really talking about are the rights of third parties. They're veterans.
What would your rule look like if we went with you? How would we avoid the problem? Right. Would we then, in every case where there's a waiver issue, have to scrutinize that to see if there's some third party that might be affected?
Your Honor, I think that when you say if there's some third party, I mean, we looked at the cases over the years of this act has been in effect, and I know the FLRA has done that, and they came up with three decisions that they thought had something to do with it, and we distinguished those in our brief. And the fact is, the normal case is not one where you get
about distinguishing cases. What is the distinction from the other body cases that takes you out of the general rule that we can't hear this?
None of the cases that the court has looked at involves a situation where there is an independent program designed by Congress for the benefit of a distinct group, the Congress has created a Veterans Recruitment Appointments Program, and that program is what's at stake here. The union is proposing to bargain that program away in a process with the Air Force, which it would lead to an agreement in which those rights would be compromised. And we're happy to address how those rights would be compromised. That we've seen nothing in any prior decision that looks like that, and I don't envision that in the future there would be many. We agree wholeheartedly that
doesn't gut what Judge Griffith and now I have been looking for is the rule that we could have for the future that says what is the special circumstance lets us get past what would normally be a bar to our hearing.
We would suggest that when there is a significant conflict between the union's proposal and a separate statutory scheme that is created for the benefit of an identifiable class of individuals, in this case, veterans, and that statutory scheme is going to be compromised by the proposal, that presents an extraordinary circumstance that warrants the court's scrutiny. Otherwise, we will end up, if this goes forward, and either by process of agreement or by imposition by an impasse panel, we will end up with a contract which basically calls on the Air Force to be in conflict with the Veterans Recruitment Appointments Program. And it does that in two ways. It forces the Air Force to change the appointments from an accepted service appointment to a term appointment, which would end before a RIF. And the FLRA is candid in conceding, and the union is candid in putting forth its proposal that the idea is to get rid of the veterans before the RIF. That's the idea. The second proposal.
I'm just wondering, would any of these veterans have standing to challenge this agreement, this proposal?
Your Honor, we've thought about. We're not sure how that would play out once this. If this court were to affirm the FLRA's decision and the process went forward and we actually ended up with an agreement or an order by an impasse panel requiring this to go forward, I think it would be a troublesome question, and it's one that we think again plays into the finding of extraordinary circumstances that we should not go down that path and end up with that situation when we can put a stop to it at this point and assess the conflict between the proposals that the union has put forward in an effort to save, it thinks, to save some jobs, but at the expense of the veterans' jobs that Congress wants to protect. And the conflict here is a very, very direct conflict. The FLRA says, oh, it's just a technicality. We're just going to change the category from accepted service to a term. But even the FLRA, as I said, recognizes that the practical result is to end this probationary period, that two-year period, without the veteran getting the competitive service job that's supposed to be at the end.
But is there anything in the statute that where Congress says that there's some protection that's given to the veterans during this two-year period? I mean, they've created this system that gives them a chance to get into the competitive service at the end of 2 years. But is there anything in the statute that says their two-year period is some sort of
The two-year period,
protection?
The term 2 years occurs in the regulation. The statute doesn't mention 2 years. But the expectation is that there will, unless the veteran doesn't do his job, his or her job, but assuming everything goes well, that the statute envisions.
The expectation, is that from the language of the statute? Or
I think the language, both the language of the statute and the regulation, detail a probationary period which will end up with a competitive service position. The effort here is to cut that process short, so the veteran never gets the competitive service position, and to say to the Air Force, you may not hire any new veterans during the period of the RIF, notwithstanding the fact that the statute and regulations empower the agency to make those hires. And here the union says, bargain away your discretion and agree with us that you won't make the hires. And in both respects, that is contrary to the program. And also, as we've indicated, and I don't have time to go into it, separately, there's an interference with Air Force management rights, both in the right to retain employees and the right to hire. And those are important as well in this case. If I see my time is about up. If there are no questions.
Your time is up now. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if needed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I think that we've touched on the critical issue here, at least with respect to the government's veterans' preference arguments, and in fact, most of its negotiability arguments as well, which is that those arguments weren't raised by the agency to the authority below, and as a result, this Court is without jurisdiction, barring an extraordinary circumstance, to hear them. The extraordinary circumstances that this Court has recognized in the past are things like constitutional issues, separation of powers considerations, and we simply don't have those here. Even accepting the government's perspective that what we have here are statutory rights intended to be reserved for third parties that may be run afoul of by virtue of the agency's failure to raise the arguments it should have raised below, that's not a circumstance that is new to this Court or to the Supreme Court. The EEOC case that the Supreme Court heard involved an agency's compliance with parts of the FAIR Act. The FAIR Act reserves rights to third-party contractors. This Court in OPM and Commerce refused to hear agencies' arguments seeking to vindicate the rights of non-bargaining unit employees, supervisors, and employees from other bargaining units, which is a classic problem under labor law, because those arguments weren't raised below.
In that context, could the offended parties have had a method of attacking what was done in separate proceedings?
I don't know.
I know in private sector labor law, you could actually bring a district court action for a failure to represent.
Well, and you certainly can do that here. My I don't know was with me starting to think from the FAIR Act perspective.
That's a good answer. If you don't know, you say you don't know. I wish more lawyers would do that instead of trying to make up an answer.
The veterans here, Your Honor, certainly had an opportunity to be involved in the process, either through whatever internal union mechanisms there were in arriving at these proposals and deciding which proposals we put forward, which we don't. Or if they were shut out of that process for some reason, or if
they were shut out of that process, then
they could file an unfair labor practice charge for the union's violation of its duty of fair representation.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. And there is no evidence in the record, Your Honors, that that was done. No veterans or veterans groups sought to intervene.
That's what I was looking for, so they could file a ULP.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And so what we're left with, I think, with respect to the 7123C arguments is an exception being presented as something that is unique and unlikely to recur, unlikely to swallow the rule. But in reality, we see a fair number of cases where third-party interests have been involved in 7123C cases. And this Court and the Supreme Court have correctly resisted the temptation to expand the definition of extraordinary circumstances to cover those instances.
Can I get you to address the second argument about whether the authority was correct that neither of these proposals excessively interfered with management rights?
Sure. And
why aren't these proposals? Why don't they interfere with management rights? I mean, they limit the ability of management to pick and choose who's going to be working for them, don't they?
I think I need to answer those separately with respect to the two proposals, if you'll indulge me with that. With respect to the first proposal, which involved the conversion of accepted service appointments to term appointments, the authority decided the case on the arguments that the agency raised to it. Those arguments are quite dissimilar from the arguments that Justice presents in its brief, as the authority points out in its brief to this Court. What the authority was confronted with below was an argument from the agency that we want to get to our RIF, and you're making us jump through all of these paperwork, HR, procedural hurdles before we get to do our RIF. And what the authority said was that no, the having to do those things does not, in fact, interfere with your ability to RIF. You still get to RIF. You know, what the agency's
not
argument
delayed like in Lucas or
that's correct, or it's in or since, right, in Luke 1, where it was, you can't do your RIF until at least this two-year period of all of the existing term appointments or accepted service appointments have been converted to competitive.
How about on the second proposal, though?
With respect to the second proposal, again, the arguments that Justice offers today aren't the arguments that the agency raised to the authority. Today, the agency is urging, for instance, that the King balancing test requires, as a separate input, an appreciation for the solicitude for veterans. That wasn't raised to the authority below, and we submit that it's wrong. The King balancing test, the way that the authority, as sanctioned by this court on I believe I can say dozens of occasions, decides whether an arrangement that interferes with management's rights is appropriate or not is by balancing the benefit of that proposal to adversely affected employees against the interference with management's reserved rights.
So there's no question that Proposal 2 does interfere.
The authority is
rights. It's a worthwhile interference.
Technically,
how so? How is it a worthwhile interference? What's the benefit that...
Let me take one half step back just so I don't mislead you, Your Honor. The authority assumed without deciding for Proposal 2 that there was an effect on management's rights. The benefit here is that, well, there were two benefits. First, it would decrease the number of positions held by accepted service employees at the time of the RIF. And why that matters is under the government-wide RIF regulations, competitive service RIFs are done separately from accepted service RIFs. Okay. The second benefit here is that it protected bump and retreat opportunities by including temporary and term positions in the RIFs. What that means is that when you define all of the positions to be RIFed, by making sure that the temporary and term positions were included in there, there were more jobs available for employees to exercise their bump and retreat rights. So those were the two benefits. And the authority has recognized over time that protecting in any way possible job interest in the case of a RIF is a significant benefit, that the threat of losing one's job is a harsh consequence of an exercise of management's rights. And so proposals like this that seek to offer shelter or that seek to increase the possibility of an employee retaining their job at the end of the process have a significant benefit. Now, the other half of that scale, Your Honor, the burden on agencies' rights is not as broad as the department would portray. The way the department portrays the burden on management's rights with respect to the hiring component of Proposal 2 is to say that we can't hire from this source over this period of time for these positions, and all of these factors just compound on each other and make it a more and more onerous imposition. Respectfully, the authority submits that that's the wrong way to look at it. What we have is the restriction of one out of literally dozens of hiring authorities for one very short period of time with respect to one narrow subclass of positions. Not even all VRA hiring is called for to be temporarily halted. Just VRA hiring for those positions that have been targeted as being part of the RIF. And so the more detail, the more layers you put on, you don't have a more onerous proposal. You have a less onerous proposal, and that it's whittling away at the impact on what the agency is free and isn't free to do. Now, as I alluded to before, a number of the agency's arguments here, not only the veterans' preference arguments, but also the negotiability arguments, have 7123C problems. We did our best to point out all of those in the brief. I'm reluctant to impose an additional burden on the court, but when you consider the department's arguments, please be mindful of of what they argued below. The agency's arguments to the authority are reproduced in the joint appendix, and I think you'll find that many, if not all, of the negotiability arguments, and certainly all of the veterans' preference arguments, were not raised in their current form to the authority. And it's not enough, I'm sorry, with just one final thought, Your Honor, it's not enough for the arguments simply to be close. This court has said in OEA from 1987 that every twist of an argument has to be raised to the authority for it to satisfy 7123C. It's not enough simply to say this interferes with management's rights and leave the authority to guess which right and how. It's certainly not enough to identify one right and then at this point change horses and say, no, we meant this other right in this other manner. And with those thoughts, unless there are questions, Your Honors, the authority rests.
Seeing none and having none, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll give back 2 minutes for rebuttal. If you need it. We don't require you to take it.
I think something that the attorney for the FLRA said really struck me, and I think it sums up the attitude, which is basically throwing out a series of objections. Certainly the extraordinary circumstances objection is very important, and we, you know, we agree that there's a strong presumption. But when he said it's only a narrow subclass that's affected here, so what? It's only a narrow subclass. Well, that narrow subclass are veterans who put themselves in harm's way for this country and expect to have certain benefits under
is
federal program.
Is it correct that those veterans could have sought relief by way of a ULP again?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if the FLRA is not bound by what the union says, that this was just part of the process of fair representation in the union's brief. The union says there's absolutely nothing wrong with favoring one group of employees over another.
You understand that my question was, is counsel correct that the veterans, as members of the bargaining unit, could have brought a ULP
for
failure to fairly represent?
I assume they could file that claim. We said, you know, that it wasn't clear that this was part of fair representation, but we don't know. Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. The other thing I'll say on the management rights front, if you look at the FLRA's brief, the big distinction is between asserting a right to lay off versus a right to retain. They make a big deal of that the magic word retain was not used there, but we've shown that they're really two sides of the same coin, and the FLRA in its own language talks about this is from the FLRA itself. It treats retain and layoff as sort of two sides of the same coin. All of a sudden, it's a critical matter. The FLRA, from the Luke 1 decision, this is not the first time the FLRA has dealt with this effort, has seen that this union has been making a concerted effort to achieve a result, and that is by compromising the rights of these veterans to achieve an objective for other members.
2 minutes, counsel, so
thank
the
you.
Case will be submitted.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And we'll take a recess. Thank you.
stuff.
It's actually just two.